You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Welcome to the Psychobetical Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Kirkpatrick. This week we have an interview with a friend of mine, Pete Rhodes, who is a retired big wall climber, and is a kind of a high achiever. He's currently building a boat to try and row across the North Atlantic, and I've been wanting to interview Pete for a long time because he sort of typifies this someone who can take on sort of big projects like one after the other, and is a very interesting character. He lives up in Scotland, up near Aberdeen. Now I've been trying to interview him for a long time because he lives in the middle of nowhere, and I've been living in the middle of nowhere, and it's kind of struggling. Like anybody who's watching any of these videos on the news at the moment, where people are Skyping people and things, it's not, the technology is still not quite there. So I interviewed him over Skype, and I have very limited amount of equipment here to try and do that properly, and I'm kind of learning as I go along. So it is what it is. If it's no good, it's no good. I did have someone email me this morning. I sent me a message that the last podcast I did, the first 20 minutes were dreadful. Now I'm not sure why. I actually went back and listened to the last 20 minutes, and the sound was okay, but maybe the content. I think anyone who comes along to listen to my podcasts, if they think it's going to be like a normal, you know, someone talking about rock boots and what kind of laces to buy and, you know, how many pull-ups to do and sets and dead hangs, then they're basically coming to the wrong place. So this podcast is, you know, if we're lucky, it might involve something to do with climbing, but really it's taking time out of my life to sit here and rab it on. Like I'm not gonna just talk about stuff I've got no interest in. So if people are offended by the things I talk about, then they can just fuck off. So but talking about investing my time for free for people and not being appreciated, I will be doing another talk this week, another talk on Wednesday night. Like last week I did the Denali in winter talk, which although I had like a lot of problems, I literally 5 minutes before I was going to start, my microphone just would not connect with the computer. And I was using this OBS streaming software, which it's only the second time I've used it. And the slides were not the right size. It was just like a disaster. But for some reason, people really enjoyed it. So I had a thank you for all the people who gave me positive feedback. That's always, and the one person who didn't. I always say like to people, I'll send you a refund, you know. So you spend half the day trying to get your slides together for this slideshow. And then, you know, instead of sitting with your wife watching Netflix, you're sat stressing out trying to get this OBS software to work. And then some asshole's like, oh, that was rubbish. I guess that's people for you. People are hell. So I'm going to be doing another one this week and I'm going to do it at 8 p.m. Dublin time. 8 p.m. Dublin time. I did say GMT, which I thought was, you know, Greenwich Mean Time, which apparently it is. My son thought it was Greenland time, but he's not really, it's like me, he's not very good at reading or noticing these things. So I didn't realize daylight saving time was 8 o'clock here is actually 8 o'clock somewhere else. A friend of mine, he once went to South Africa, and everything was a disaster, and everything was like no one was on time, and people were always late. Everything they did, people were always late, and they were like, you know, TIA, like, this is Africa, and you know, TIA, all this kind of stuff. Anyway, it was only when they were going to the airport to leave that they realized the time was different, and the watches were like an hour ahead of everybody else's, so actually everyone was on time or early and didn't realize it. I'm talking about my first sort of forays into winter alpine climbing, leading up to my epic ascent of the Frendo Spur, where all sorts of epic things happened. So I hope people join me there. I think I was saying last time, I said that if anyone's got any comments in the chat, then please put them in there and I'll try and answer them at the end. And I think I was just like so frazzled and stressed out by trying to run the OBS thing that I didn't manage it. So, unfortunately the podcast, the Denali slideshow, because it's part of a tour and because it wasn't really up to scratch, you know, I've not really done that talk before. So I'm just talking about it. It's not like a proper sort of slideshow. It's not up on YouTube anymore. Because it's, you know, anyway, probably like this podcast. So 8 p.m. Dublin time, YouTube live Wednesday. So I hope you can join me there. And so I'll crack on with this Skype recording. There's a break in the middle because it just stopped working. Hopefully you won't notice it. And the audio quality is Skype, but I think if you like hang on in there and listen, like I probably talk too much, I do apologize, and the sound, I'm a bit louder than he is, but anyway, you're tough individuals. I'm sure you can, you know, I'm not bloody Brian Eno, like I hope you can appreciate it is what it is. Anyway, see you on Wednesday. Every day is like we're sat here watching that Mrs. Peregrine's House of Disturbed Children film. Have you ever seen that?
No, I've not seen that one.
But it's like the most, like, it's supposed to be a kids film, I think, but it's like horrific. It's got like people eating children's eyes and things, and but it's just, they're living in this world where every day is the same, you know, at the end of the end of the day they turn back the clock and they begin again, and it's a little bit like that for everybody at the moment. It's like Groundhog Day, but not in a good way, really.
I don't think he was happy with it. Yeah, it's odd. Like, I'm furloughed from work, so we're just in the garden until the
end of the night. All right. I remember someone telling me that I met someone who lived in East Germany, and he said how people were like really promiscuous. Like, you would just go, you'd go and get the bus, and this woman would be on the bus stop and say, like, do you want to have sex? And you go, okay, then you go and have sex with somebody, because there was nothing to do. Like, life. life was so boring and there's nothing ever happened. And this was before Netflix. So if they had Netflix like in the Soviet Union, maybe things would have worked out much better. Like, comrade, did you see the cat, the Tiger King last night? Hey, it's so good. You know, do you want to have sex? No, no, I'm watching Mad Men series two. So it's kind of surreal, isn't it? Sorry,
it is. It's yeah, but no, we're getting on. It took a few weeks to get used to it.
Yeah, you're not like killed any of your family or anything.
No, there's enough that you can choose the ones that aren't winding you up in this house.
how many people in your house?
Well, there's four children. So we've got
four children.
A soon to be 8 year old, a 6, a 4, and a 2.
Yeah. Oh wow. 6, 4, 6, 4, 2, 6. Yeah. God.
Yeah.
So that's quite a lot of kids, isn't it?
It's just right.
It's two more than you're meant to have. Like you're only allowed to have two.
I know. Yeah. Child benefit told us that. we love it.
Never have more kids that you can never have more than two kids because there's only ever four seats in a McDonald's. So
we end up on the bench.
Yeah. So one of those bench families there.
Yeah, we are. The one right by the toilet. I don't know, it just happened. We're just two was easy, I think.
Yeah.
We quite like them all, so it's grand.
It's good to know when you say if you've got two kids, I used to say like I've got three kids, one of each. And in America, you can always tell if someone's listening to you because they would say, oh, great, oh, good, good, or whatever. And then in America, they'd be like, what? You could three kids, one of each. And then they would like, it would, you know, because the old joke was, I've got a boy, a girl, and a hairdresser. That was like a 1970s kind of joke.
Can't say that anymore.
But now you could say, I've got a boy, a girl, and a... undecided, so it's kind of come full circle now, so it's kind of good.
We haven't gone down that route. We're all pretty safe.
There's nothing wrong with it. Nothing wrong with it. You know,
I'm not saying it is.
You know, no. I know you live in Scotland. You know, they're very backward up there.
We're just the right side of comfortable.
Yeah. So you live up near Aberdeen?
Yeah, just sort of 30 minutes outside Aberdeen, towards the
Cape. All right. Yeah.
So that's just, we came up, 6 years ago?
Yeah.
Just for work. Because I do rope access, or I've done rope access the last 15 years.
Yeah.
This is where it used to pay, but now it's starting to ebb and flow a little bit.
Yeah, boom and bust.
Yes, it's a wild industry, and then it's had another bust lining up with this thing. So the oil price
has kind of got
as this came in, so it's chaos up here.
Yeah.
We shall see what the rest of the year brings.
Yeah, it's kind of weird when you got kids, you know, when you see, like my daughter, like yesterday, she got like a first in maths, you know, from Leeds University. But you think like, what good is it? You know, like it's about the...
Well, I did economics.
I think it's my house.
Now I abseil on, and now I write procedures for people to abseil on buildings. So it doesn't have to relate. It just, it makes you, a university degree just helps you grow up. It just helps you learn to argue properly.
Yeah. I think it's too much of that already.
Not arguing the argument, but at least stand by what you understand.
Yeah.
It's arbitrary. You can do whatever you like after it.
Yeah. Yeah, my cousin's a professor. And he, when he was at school, like one day the headmaster came up and, you know, intentionally found his mum and told like my auntie, like, your son is never going to amount to anything. You know, like he's totally out of control. He's like a crazy person. Anyway, so, you know, 30 years later, he's like a professor of economics. But I often think when I think about the two of us, we both have these completely different lives. You know, I have no qualifications in anything whatsoever. You know, and he, you know, we see the world in such a different way. And I wonder if like how you bring your kids up, you know, how they're practical, how they can, you know, how resilient they are, or, you know, how they can cope with adversity and things. Seems to be quite an important skill these days.
Yeah. We're definitely conscious of it. But whether you can actually teach it or not, I don't know. I think you have to have experienced it first.
Yeah, right. Neglect. I think neglect's the key, I think.
Yeah. I'm not sure what the modern word is for that. No, it's like, it's semi-feral, isn't it? You've got to let them go for it.
Yeah.
But I guess that's why we do all this stuff we do, is that you try and show them you can do it and everything else, and then...
You won't die.
Yeah, and that you choose the harder stuff, don't you? There's something about the satisfaction. It's like a grim satisfaction. That's all we're aiming for in this world.
Yeah.
Like,
I'm just trying to make it through to the end. That's all I care. I don't really care.
Well, yeah, you say that. But...
It's almost like, you know, like if you're trying to get through life and there's, you know, like in a film where there's, you're just like pushing him out the way to get, you know, to get to the exit. You know, like, you know, people like hanging on you. Like, he knows where he's going. He's like, no, I don't.
Yeah. Definitely don't know where we're going.
Don't look for me for any advice.
No, I know. Yeah, the people, like, because this row is probably the most public thing I've ever done, or it seems to have. You've had, because it's funded, you have to make it public, and they're like, I've never really talked about stuff I've done, and people come up to you with weird questions and assume that what you say is sage advice because you're capable of attempting this thing.
This is the podcast. Someone I get all these, because I keep joking about how I ramble on in these podcasts and I'm really conscious of it, and then but people always email me going like, oh no, the rambling's the only good bit, like the rest of it's shit or whatever. So this evening, I'm talking to Pete Rhodes, the famous Pete Rhodes, so I've known Pete. Have we actually ever physically met each other?
Yes, we met
at Kendall or something.
Kendall and an Alpkit festival where we were both teaching aid climbing classes.
Oh yeah. So I've got to the age now where I have trouble remembering not only names but people I've ever met you before. So Pete, in a former life, he might still be in his current life. He was a climbing person, big wall climber, all this kind of stuff. And so we had this plan at one time to go and try and climb the troll wall together, didn't we? And then I think we had, like, it was a very loose plan. We hadn't bought any tickets. And then the next minute, Pete was like, I've decided to go by myself. I was like, oh God, that's a bit of a, you know, that's like, I've met someone else myself. So Pete went off with himself to, I think, was it in the winter time?
I went to try and get the first winter ascent of that, what was it called?
It's Sussigiri Harryland, or it's called.
That's the badger. So yeah. It hadn't been done in winter. So I went out for the end of the winter season in, I don't know, 2011. And when I got there, there's that car park at the bottom. I pulled into the car park about 11 o'clock and there was a sign, there's an illuminated sign that tells you the time and the temperature. And it flicked through to the temperature and it said 1 degree Celsius, like plus one. So I was like, oh no, that must be bust. Like, I'm in Norway in the middle of February, it's not 1 degree. So I went to sleep in the van and got up, like, and it was about 8 degrees in the day. So I'd gone hoping this thing would be frozen solid and not coming down in chunks. Crossed the railway and walked up out the woods, and the whole of the base was just avalanche debris.
Yeah,
I used to just strip clean. So I went and touched it and came home.
did some guys not come and tell you? Oh, there was something weird thing on UK climbing. Was like, oh, there's an English man and he's Norway trying to solo the troll wall, and everyone was like, who is he? Who? It was like a weird, weird kind of thing, wasn't it?
Yeah. So I met Odrall Wilk, who was 10 years ago. He was very keen and capable. I think he lives in the area, and a couple of other guys who were actually keen and just chatting. And the police came over and said they'd look after the van. But yeah, I think
very Norwegian.
Yeah. But I just wasn't going to touch it when it was hot.
Yeah.
I wanted, the whole reason I went in February was so it might have been a little bit more stuck together.
Yeah.
So that was a nice week driving to Norway and back.
I remember when I went to try and solo the troll wall, I remember thinking, I'm driving all this way. I'm not going to come back unless I'm either dead or I've done it. And unfortunately, I didn't manage to do both. So, But but it's a hell of a long way to drive, isn't it? It's not like popping to, like, I'm going to go down to Devon and it's raining, I'll drive all the way back. It's it's a hellish place to drive.
Definitely the most galling turnaround I've ever made.
Yeah.
Because,
but then, I can't remember his name now, but I was at a gig somewhere and this guy turned up who is, this is the thing where I can't remember people's names, but who tried to solo the Swedish route and he got hit by loads of rocks and he ended up being quadriplegic. And, you know, when a guy turns up in a wheelchair who literally can't move anything, who was trying to solo the troll wall, you know, it puts into perspective really like how ridiculous it is, those kind of,
it's a funny one, isn't it? Like, I don't know why it appealed. You get sucked down funny routes, don't you? Because we'd had those two seasons in Patagonia that we did, and then we came back, and I soloed the scoop on Harris.
Oh, yeah.
And then I was like, oh, I'm really good at Choss now, because I've done one Choss pile. What else can I go and aid that's Choss, and maybe find something that someone will give us a few quid for? And that was... That was the biggest pile of Choss in Europe, so I went for that.
Maybe in the world, maybe.
I don't know. So, yeah, it's a funny old progression, but you just sort of go with it.
Well, you see, the trouble seems to attract weird people, I think.
Yeah, but so does aid climbing. If you go aid climbing and then winter aid climbing and then loose winter aid climbing, you're not going to get many normals.
It's more like caving, I think.
Yeah, I did a bit of caving recently. Well, not recently, a few years ago. I got really into it for like a year.
Yeah,
it's great.
Oh, it's real. That's real adventure. Like,
so good. I'm not the right size for it, turns out.
Yeah, just it takes some more dynamite.
Yeah,
because I think that's the thing people often don't understand in climbing. So, you know, I often have some argy bargy with like James McCaffey, but I often say to like James, like, what I do is not that I'm like a cave diver and you're a surfer. Like, there's no way you can ever, you know, be slagging me off what I do. Like, you've got no idea what I do, you know, and I've got a bit of an idea what you do, because I kind of do a bit of it, but you have no idea what I do. Like, you have to go and get on some Chossy A5 whatever on your Skyhooks, and then you might, you know. So I think it is a weird thing, but it definitely attracts weird kind of characters and things.
Yeah, I don't know whether how weird I come across it after someone else.
But did it, so that, did driving all the way back from Norway, was that like a turning point in your climbing life, do you think?
I think after that, I then went to the valley in the spring. It wasn't long after that I basically stopped cold turkey. I don't think that was the beginning of the end. I couldn't tell. I lose track. That's nearly 10, well, it's not 10, it's 8-9 years ago now. I think we had a Dolomites trip after that, which was really good. Just like social, easier routes. And then I went to the valley again, just for like 2.5 weeks or something, a quick trip. Assuming it would just be another normal valley trip, and had decent plans. And got there and I took my brother, so we did half dome in a day to warm up. Because he, bless him, he's not a climber, but every time he ties in, he's fine.
Yeah.
So this year's route was half dome in a day. and we just got up to into the chimney, out the top of the chimneys. And I was just going up this fist crack, and I can remember the jam and put this fist jam in. And I was like, that's enough. There's some switch, like it was like a light bulb. And that was that. Like, I was like, I've done enough of this.
Yeah.
And then lightning hit the top of half dome when we were on it. So we bailed because there was rocks coming down all the cracks in the chimney.
Yeah.
By the time that grim abseiling with a punter was done, I was cooked.
The thrill was gone.
Yeah, it was like literally like a switch, and that was that. I've tied in about 4 times the last 8 years.
Yeah. Oh wow. Is it like falling out of love with somebody?
Yeah. I don't know. I wasn't. Yeah, I wasn't cross or sad about it. I was just like, that's. But just there's something I think now, looking back at it, I think I need like a depth of like, well, with this new project, which will, do you want me to introduce a new project and then tell you why I think I'm doing it?
Yeah, go on then. Yeah.
So the current plan, and there's been a few, so I quit climbing 8 years ago, cold turkey, and then I've looked for ways to fill the gap. And so basically I've done something every year that's filled a year, but it's not really been, climbing's got such a depth and breadth to it that you can spend every minute of every hour thinking about what you're doing and which route you're going and which trip you're planning and, you know, thinking about knots and systems and all the rest of it. And it just seemed to fill my mind. And then it didn't, which I think I'd got to the point where the learning curve had flattened and I was just sort of repeating what I knew. And so that might be the reason I stopped. And then these simpler things I've chosen, they filled like 6 months. And then you sort of get, again, it's an addiction to the steep side of the learning curve, I think. And so, so here's the full background. I'm gonna ramble now and you can, they can complain about me. So 2 years ago, our fourth child was born. And a week after he was born, he got really poorly, really quickly. And we rushed him to the hospital, which is about 45 minutes away. And when he got into the emergency room, he was 32 degrees and he was gray from the chest down. So they did all sorts of incredible stuff. They flew him to Glasgow. And within 24 hours, he'd had heart surgery to cut a section of his aorta out that closed off. So he basically wasn't getting any blood below his heart. Right. And he was like half an hour away from not making it, basically, when we got there. So they were amazing. He was fixed. If you're going to get heart surgery, that's the one to get, because he was under for 40 minutes. They chopped out a section of his heart, of his aorta, sewed it back together while it was running. And then in a week, we were home. And this is on a 7-day-old baby, so a 5-pound baby.
Wow.
It's astounding. So it took us a while to get over that, or we felt like it did, and sort of process it, and with a baby, obviously. And then we were watching Netflix, as you do, as we've discussed. And there's a documentary about four girls that rode the Pacific.
Oh, yeah, good documentary, that. Yeah.
Yeah. So at the end of that, I just turned to Kate, and I was like, oh, I look pretty cruiser. I was like, I reckon I could have that. And she's like, well, go on then. So it went like that. And so I took that and ran with it, because you don't get those sorts of permission slips every day. And then because we had, and it'll sound a bit awful, but we've got like the X Factor story. We finally had a cause to raise money for because of what they did to Cedar. And that sort of X Factor spin lets you go out, because ocean rowing isn't cheap compared to like flying to the valley for a month, which is really cheap. An ocean rowing boat isn't cheap. So you have to go out, and I've never done the corporate sponsored drive and going asking or begging for money. That I knew that would be the crux, but because we had this story, I could spin it up. So
I'll have to interject here, because anyone listening to this is like, oh Christ, here's one of these like posh blokes who's like, oh yes, I wanted to sail around the world and I was trying to save up money, but luckily the day before I went, my friend had a boat. He was, you know, like a luxury yacht, and he lent it to me. But so I should point out that you've actually built your own boat.
So because you're going asking for commercial money, and you see ocean rowing now is coming, that most people have at least heard of someone that might have rowed the Atlantic, and Ben Fogel did it 15 years ago or whatever. So it's done. The standard ocean rowing trip costs you about £120,000, because you have to go and buy one of these boats from one or two manufacturers. And then the classic route is to do the race across the Atlantic, and the entry fee alone is £25,000. So there's cost spiral, and I wasn't going to go. What I find galling about those sorts of people, not people, those sorts of undertakings, is that you go and ask for £100,000 of corporate money and you get it because you're shiny and capable, but then you give £15,000 to charity at the end.
Yeah.
You burn £85,000 into your experience.
Like a sponsored parachute.
Yeah. Like, so I couldn't do that. So I was like, right, how can I make sure I'm net gate, like zero sum cost? So I've raised, well, the boat, if you go and buy a commercial boat, it costs you about £80,000. I couldn't do that. So the parts for my boat cost about £20,000. And then, so basically, my labor fills that gap. So if I can sell it for more than it cost, then not only do we reclaim all the corporate sponsorship to give to the hospital, but we might even make more than it did. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So I couldn't face the idea of burning 40 grand of someone's cash just for me to have a nice couple of months on the sea. But if I can raise even more than the total that I've gone out and got by selling the boat at the end, then that seems fair to me. So I've raised double or whatever.
Yeah.
And then, so that's my R investment, because it's as much Kate's time as it was mine to build the thing. That's our investment, our donation once we sell it, is the time that we spent to put the value into the boat.
So a few reasons I wanted to talk to you, because people, like, you know, climbers are very, very extremist, like, oh God, a podcast about a rower, what's that got to do with climbing? But I'm very interested in, first of all, there's a big psychological thing here about what you're about to do. Mm. And because you're doing this by yourself.
Yeah, absolutely.
But also this idea of taking on like this massive project to build a boat, because, you know, even just a gun, you know, off the shelf boat, get someone to build it for you, it's quite a big deal. But yeah. I'm trying to finish this book, and it's been like I realize I'm actually a year late now, but it's ended up being this crazy project. It's just literally is, like I always say, that when I write a book, it's like squeezing your brain, getting all the information out. But this is just to be like the nth degree of that. So I was very, when I've been watching you building your boat on Instagram, I've been thinking that, Christ, at least at the end of, when I finish this book, I just sell it. You know, but you've actually got to sit in it and row across the Atlantic. So first of all, do you have any experience of building boats?
I do now. Yeah, I've got an ocean rowboat. No, I don't. I built our camper van.
All right.
And I'd consider myself handy,
if
not classically trained. So that was one of the things of what I was talking about. Like, this project seemed the right size for me because there was so much to learn. So I can spend every hour, like, I commute for an hour and a half every day, and we've got an hour at lunchtime, and any point where my brain isn't fully engaged, it gives me like 100 problems to think through and solve and learn about. So that's why this appealed, because I knew it was a massive undertaking. Like, I've never done any fiberglass before. I've only had a handful of days out in boats. Like, that side of it, absolutely.
Do you get seasick?
I don't know. We'll find that out. Everyone gets seasick, I think. It's how long you're seasick for is the query. That's to be discerned.
So, someone once told me that if you ever want to row the Atlantic, you should just go to the Canaries and just wait there. And when people set off, when they've paid this 100 grand, often on day one, they can't do it and they have to come back again. And then they need to swap that person out. And they're like, look, the free trip to go across the Atlantic. Do you want to come? And like, go on then, I'll get on it. And they'll... So that's one way of doing it.
All right. Yeah, I could maybe get a dry run. Just fish for the punters. Yeah, so no, the reason the reason I can, you're testing my phrases now because you'll get knifed for them, won't you? The reason I think I'm capable, I can justifiably put myself in that position, that's the difference. I wanted to set my own, not standard, but, you know, like, climbing's full of daft rules, isn't it? You've got arbitrary, ridiculous rules that no one understands, and even, like, if you go and do a route, or this is aid parlance now, if you go and do a route clean, nobody cares. But you've set yourself this, like, micro goal that's completely arbitrary, but it suits you, or it interests you, or it appeals to you, or something. And so what I've done with this is I've, like, taken the project and I've looked at how everyone else has done it, and I've accepted the bits that I think make a fair rule, and I've changed the bits that I don't think. That didn't appeal, so I wanted to build my own boat because that's part of the challenge, and it makes it more of a solo. Like, not that I've gone and cropped it and handed away cheese and, you know, knocked people back, but I've bought it into being our own rather than my own, but our family's endeavor. So there's that sort of side of it. But then I think I can justifiably be out there because of all the stuff I've done up to now. So no, I'm not ocean savvy, but I can be on my own, and I can be in sketchy places, and I can make big decisions quickly, and all that sort of demonstrated. And what you see, if you read all the books, like, the Talisker books or anyone else that's done Ocean Rose, what amazes me is people have put themselves in the middle of an ocean with no concept of how they respond under stress or no experience of deep underlying threat.
And fear. Yeah. Was it Tom McLean or one of the guys where he'd never been on a ferry? Like he rode across the North Atlantic and only once been on a boat and he had no idea. And the all they had was an open boat with a tarpaulin and a blow up mattress. Like, yeah. I think they had like a 50% chance of dying, didn't they?
Yeah.
And the other team did die.
Yeah. The guys, the sort of the original guys, the 1800s and the early 1900s and the early 20th century, those guys are a different, that's a different sport.
Yeah, they were like astronauts, really, weren't they?
Yeah, just casting off with a sextant and an open boat and two buckets, and all their water in a barrel.
Yeah,
like stuff like that. So yeah, what those guys,
Cornish miners, and they sailed in a tiny little, like a rowing boat all the way to Australia because it had there was a gold rush. It took them like 2 or 3 years, and when they got there, the gold rush had finished.
Amazing.
But all these people were doing these things long before anyone. Like I always talk about, like that Hans Lindemann, who like kayaked across in the Klepper from the Canaries all the way to the Caribbean in like 1951 or something. Yeah. And people did that now in like a carbon fiber, singing dancing kayak. It'd be like big. It'd be sponsored by Red Bull, but no one even knows that this guy did it in like 11-foot kayak. All he had was beer and milk. That's all he took with him. But he was like, he kept saying that, I will never eat Freddy Wheat. Yeah, go west, I will make it. That's all he kept saying. He's like a self-hypnosis kind of thing.
Right.
But amazing what people can do. But do you ever have these, so has the boat worked? Have you plans and everything, I guess?
Yeah, so all this current situation sort of scuppered it. So the plan was to be departing in like a week from Canada. So
you're going. So you're going to do the North Atlantic, which is hard man.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So that was the plan up to a month ago, and now it's all up in the air. So I'm not quite decided on, and I don't think I can justifiably decide yet until we see sort of which way everything falls. But there's two options: either I delay a whole year and do the North Atlantic route, which is from Newfoundland back to Scotland, or if everything is calm enough by Christmas, there's a route from Portugal to Miami.
Yeah.
So mainland to mainland, and that's never been soloed.
Yeah.
So it's just long, basically.
Yeah.
But so that's an option to go in the winter. But it's nice down there. So
there's the weather, wasn't some guy who the smallest, I think that was Tom McLean, who had the record, he was doing the smallest. But then there was a guy who sailed from Ireland across to Canada, like in the winter time, in some tiny, like 11-foot long boat or something. But he was a crazy Christian, I think.
Amazing. Yeah. I think I saw some guy trying to do it in a 4'6" thing.
Yeah.
It was just like a box with a square mast and a really long keel. I mean, he had to sleep standing up.
Oh, my God. So, you know, I think there's a thing in life where the people who really know what they're doing would not do it.
Yeah.
And it's the people just know enough to give it a go, don't know any better, I was looking at a yacht and I was like, I emailed this friend of mine. So I said, I've seen this yacht. It's like, it's only like $3,000. And it's like, and it's on eBay. And what do you think? And he was like, well, what kind of yachts have you been on before? I was like, I've never been on a yacht.
And you want to sail to like Madagascar or something.
Yeah. If we're going to, I'll go all the way around, just go the whole hog.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder a lot about whether one can actually be content and not have to do this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Have to is not quite the right word, but there's definitely an underlying need of some of this level of engagement in my life. It'd just be nice if you could just be like, oh yeah, I took the dog for a walk today.
So have you got, is it because you've got like spare capacity in your brain?
Well, that's very generous of you. Yeah, but it'd be even more satisfying to find a use of that capacity that aided more than just my undertaking risky activity.
You mean like making money?
Well, that would help. Yeah, or even helping society. Either of those. you know, furthering the human race.
I think we help society by just getting out, staying out of the way, I reckon. That's the...
inspiring a generation.
I've gone by newspapers for old people. I have this thing about, I think today I tweeted that fast food is bad for the body and fast information is bad for the mind or something like that. But like I got this thing about never consuming any news or never consuming any newspapers. And my happiness level is like magnified massively, but I seem to end up having to buy newspapers for old people at the moment. They have to go to the news. I have to go to the newsrooms every day, get all these newspapers. And old people read a fuck of a lot of newspapers. It's amazing. Like, can you get me the Guardian? Get me the Irish Times? Can you get me the wow. It's like, what the hell are you doing with your day? Just sitting watching the reading all these.
Yeah, it's definitely an inside life at the moment.
Maybe it's not having all that stuff in your mind, but your capacity. It's like having loads of 50 screens open on your computer. If you only got the one, which is growing across the Atlantic.
Yeah. Yeah. It definitely is. It's filling the background noise. Yeah. Hang on. We've gone a bit broken up here.
And what do you think about... can you hear me now?
I can hear you now.
Do you like wake up in the middle of the night and you're thinking about desalinators and things like that?
Yeah. Yeah, obviously. I mean, that's just any healthy adult in his mid-30s, isn't it? Yeah. You know, when you're out in the garage or you can't fix something or you come in, my mood tends a lot on what is and isn't functioning and what has and hasn't worked that previous round. Like, if you've broken something or if you can't work out why it doesn't, like the classic why the bike doesn't start sort of. Yeah, I run pretty tight on that stuff, but that's fine, isn't it?
Oh. Someone said, "What did Plato and Napoleon do when there's no wars? Like, what do these people do?" And maybe you're one of those people where really you should have been involved in a war or some, some huge.
Yeah, I don't know. I always wondered about the Dean Potter household, like how do they function on the downtime?
Yeah,
like guys like that that run so close to the wire the whole day.
Yeah,
they then go home and do the washing up.
They're just totally stoned, I think, most of the time.
Okay. Yeah,
I think a lot.
I've never tried that option.
I think I've had a window into the lives of some of those people, and you would not want to be them. Like, they're incredibly dysfunctional, to a clinical level, I think.
Yeah.
You know, like, especially, I'm always really wary of Americans who have this kind of Zen, kind of Buddhist kind of thing. Because it always reminds me, I think someone said, scratch a hippie, find a Nazi. you know, it's all about money, basically. They're talking about, you know, rainbows and, unicorns. But they've got like 15 houses they've got mortgages for. And they're, they're selling meth on the back, it's not what you think it is,
Okay.
So it's. Someone said that about Uli Steck. So Uli Steck, so he died, was it 3 weeks, 3 years ago? And, and I think he, it's hard to know. I think it's very hard if you're on this constant treadmill of what next.
Mm-hmm.
Like Neil Armstrong was the only man in history probably where no one asked him what is he going to do next.
Yeah, that's true.
But yeah,
there
it's
some expectation, isn't there?
Because as soon as you
perform like a dancing monkey.
Because you'd be halfway across the Atlantic and you'd be thinking, oh, the Pacific. I'll do the Pacific next.
Yeah, no, I've got some ideas, but I'm not allowed to talk about those because it's a brownie points game, isn't it?
Yeah.
This is suck the barrel. So we have to get this one done and earn some brownie points for the next endeavor. So we don't talk about the future. I can't see me doing more than one ocean. Like, I get the feeling after 2 months of the same thing every day, you don't need to do the same thing every day again.
But yeah.
I might be wrong.
It's actually very simple, isn't it?
Yeah, that does appeal. Like, but it appeals in a funny way because, like, you can sort of, and you might be the same. Like, if you imagine how a wall is going to feel, you basically know now, having done enough of this sort of activity, you know how your mind's going to go, like day one to day three, and then what you're going to miss and what you might want and all the rest of it. You can almost, like, I could sit here now and I could map out the emotions that will be due and when they're coming and what they'll mean and all the rest of it, because it's almost prosaic at this point whether you do it or not.
Yeah,
it's just been, yeah, there's something about the planning and prep that fills me enough that I don't have to worry about it. And then the actual undertaking, it's only, and we used to say this about climbing a lot, that what it really does is it gets you to a point where you have to make decisions that feel like they've got value. So you invest a year of your life planning a trip to Pakistan or whatever, and you get there and you can't, I don't know, the route's out of condition, or, well, like the troll wall trip. You drive, you spend 6 months buying kit and planning and earning money. You drive for 4 days and you get there and it's out of condition and you turn around and come home.
Yeah.
But you've had the opportunity to get yourself into a position to make a decision that you might make once in a decade in terms of intrinsic value to yourself.
Yeah.
And I don't know why that's satisfying or useful, but that seems to be the only aim that you can have with it, because you can't aim for it to be a success.
Yeah.
That's naive. Like, I still give myself, I think, at best a 50% chance, even though I've managed to build a boat in a year and get ready, like, and I'm fit and I'm healthy and all the rest of it, it's still 50-50. And
yeah,
I could care less whether it works or not, almost.
Yeah.
But if I get the chance to make these decisions, then it will have been a success.
Yeah. I like this idea that no climb or event in your life is in isolation. You shouldn't think of it, you know, as like picture frames. You should think of it as one continuous event in a way.
Yeah.
So every summit leads to another summit, or leads to something else, another summit, something completely different.
Yeah.
But they're all connected. But if you always live in this way where you're thinking, you know, what's next? You know, it's this really rigid, you know, I didn't get to the top, and rah, rah, rah. And it's good to get to the top of these things eventually, but it's all that, you know. I think there's that really good thing. I think, was it Seb Coe or something? You know, he was like, I think he had like the world record for the 400 meters in Oslo, I think it was. And he said that, you know, when he did it, when he brought this record, he knew there'd be other records he would break in the future and he would do even better. But he never did. But he only realized this like 10 years later or 20 years later. He was looking back from the valley up at the summit of his life. But really, it's not good to think, you know, that, what's that awful thing? Like, what if you've already had the best moment in your life?
Yeah.
And it's like, you don't want to think like that. Because
it's awful.
Because they have all these different kind of, shades, you know, of experience. Yeah. You know, often the worst things are quite good in the end.
Yeah. Usually, they're usually the most interesting, but that sort of stuff, we've been struggling, because if you go, like, well, so my work's been my main sponsor for the boat, and so obviously I'm talking about it a lot at work, and we're working quite a big company, so you talk to people you never talked to before, and the first thing they say to you is, I couldn't do that.
Yeah.
And you're like, yeah, I know you couldn't, that's fine, but you have to sort of tone it around. Like, I've been trying to work on a way to describe it, like the classic, like couch to 5k that anyone can do, takes anyone from never exercising like 6 weeks and they can run a 5k. So if you imagine putting in like double that effort every day for 18 months,
yeah,
like, as a runner, you could be an amazing runner.
Yeah.
And then if you did that building on having done it for 10 years, and it's that cumulative experience. It might not be relevant, but it's similar.
Yeah.
And then you put 2,000 hours and 18 months of your life into it.
Oh, yeah. So we were talking about, like, when I interviewed Jim Herrington, and right in the middle of it, this old woman turned up, like, was begging for money. It was like, sorry, love, I'm in the middle of something. So, yeah, we basically were talking about, like, the, you know, the 10,000 hours thing, weren't you, really?
Yeah, I think so.
Some people do seem to be able to just off the couch do like incredible things. Have you read the Goggins book?
Yeah, that wasn't off the couch.
No.
Yeah, he was 10,000 hours deep into a variety of things. I think that's the difference. It's like,
yeah, the interesting.
Go on.
I think the interesting thing about Goggins is he kind of, I'm surprised he never went into his book, but it basically turned into this, like, a total asshole, like his father, like a crazy person, really.
Well, he didn't go into it because he wrote it.
Yeah. But he's on his like third wife and, you know, what happened to all these women and children? And
yeah, I did feel that was a shame in that book, that there was a daughter that just got a one-liner, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
Or didn't, that side of it didn't appeal. But then, like, I read that book, and I won't say it's relatable, but the things he tries to teach in it, the focusing on yourself and self-learning and, like, understanding toughness and that sort of stuff, I didn't feel like I had to learn it.
But yeah.
I appreciated what he was explaining, and it was the methods were for other people. Like, I felt like, yeah, that hardship and self-awareness is basically what I've been learning.
Yeah.
In a variety of guises. Like, and yeah, it's not off the couch. Like, so one of the things I did, and this is blow my own trumpet now, but in post-climbing in the lake, in the doldrums before the rowing, I started running when we moved to this house, just because we're living near the woods now. So I started just running the dog, and I was like, oh, what can I do with running? Because I'm not just going to do it arbitrarily without a goal. And I phoned up one of my mates, and I was like, do you think I could do the Bob Graham? Like, how long do you think it takes from... And I haven't really run, or, like, I can run, but I'd never run. And I was like, how long does it take? And basically I said, can I do it in 3 months? Because I think I'll get bored of running after 3 months. It's pretty repetitive. So he was like, no, you can't do it in 3 months. So that was enough to have a go at it.
And you do it?
Yeah. But
oh, wow.
Someone told me at the end, because I was talking to someone about it at the wedding, I was like, oh, I did it. And I was like, yeah, oh, you could do it too. Because you run for 4 hours and then you walk for 8 hours and then it really sucks, but it's only 12 hours and then it's finished. And he was like, you did that like a climber. Like, you just didn't care. Like, you just went out, knew it was 24 hours and knew it sucked and just did it.
So if anyone doesn't know what the Bob Graham is, Google it. It's like pretty impressive. It's like you just go and walk like one leg of it. You think, oh, maybe you do the Bob Graham. You do like a fifth of it. It takes you all day long and you're knackered at the end of it. And you're like, yeah, Christ.
It was an optimistic undertaking. But and that was another one. Like, you see these like machines that get people around with teams of four on every leg and all that.
Yeah.
I had four helpers for the whole day. And like, they shared the shuttle driving. One of my dad and my brother, and then two friends, and they each ran a leg each. And yeah, I wasn't going to do it as this mega event, but I'd also never seen it. Like, we lived in Penrith, so I had seen some of the hills, but I'd never run any of it until the day. So it was sort of on site. I just made sure my pacers knew where they were going. And I don't think I even looked at the view. It was just, it's like, I'm really bad at looking at the view. I don't know about you. Like, people say, oh, you go to these amazing places and isn't it wonderful and doesn't it look beautiful? I'm like, I yeah, probably, but I'm the wrong person to ask. Like, yeah, I didn't do any of that. There's just some grim sense of satisfaction from finishing arbitrary endeavor that you've set yourself, and it's another
internal view you're looking at.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, but I've seen the back of that pain cave before.
Yeah,
I don't know why. It's not an interesting place. It's just a dark hole.
There's that really good bit in the Goggins book where he's trying to get into Delta Force, and his guy's like, you're the kind of guy who wants to get captured and see if you can withstand torture or something.
Good old.
Yeah. I remember going to a talk, and it was a guy who got shot down in Iraq and he was tortured, like an RAF pilot, RAF navigator. And I remember just thinking, like, wow, what an amazing story. Like, he came through it, you know, and you know, he's a really interesting character. You know, had no interest in, you know, writing books about it, but he's, you know, the story he had was really incredible. You know, the reality of ejecting out of a plane in a war, you know, with floating down into an airfield full of bomb craters and soldiers just been bombing them. And like, really, you know, like, you get people writing books about climbing and stuff. This, you know, it's like, it's really, has it's got, you know, that's real. That's the real McCoy. That is, you know, but it's, but no, it just seems some people just suddenly find themselves in really incredible situations, and they seem to be able to. Well, I think most people actually cope really well. You know, a human being, they have this thing hardwired into them. But in a real disaster, you know, when it really is a disaster, they start whinging and whining and complaining, and they just get on with it, really.
Yeah, and we're privileged to be making these first world options of suffering, aren't we? We go out and look for arbitrary short periods of suffering.
Yeah.
Console ourselves on. Yeah, it's all very random. Yeah,
I was living on 500 calories. 500 calories a day for 2 months, you know. And I finished with a big bottle of champagne and all that, you know, a huge meal. And there's people living like that every day, so.
I mean, yeah, I don't want, like, I often wonder or joke that I shouldn't speak to psychiatrists. I don't want to know too much about the whys. Like, because if you sort of knew the answer, you wouldn't have to bother.
Yeah.
You could find some, I don't know, probably drugs. You could find something that would just, like,
normalize you.
Yeah, I think I could be a really good addict in a different life. You know, you can get into anything, can't you? And it's just finding what flicks the switch that week. But yeah, it's you don't want to know. You almost don't want to know the answer, because then you wouldn't have to do all this daft stuff to find it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, don't, when you meet people who've got like an incredible amount of money, you know, they've got as much, you know, more money than like 10 lifetimes worth of money.
Yeah.
But I've never met anyone like that who's really, really happy. Their problems just change into something, you know, they've got a crack in the swimming pool, you know, there's like but I think it is, you know, this, I always say this, it's, you know, this, the stoical thing, you have to imagine less to be happy.
Yeah.
And I think maybe a lot of people are experiencing that right now. Like, they literally cannot even go for a walk. You know, some people, you know, if you're 70, whatever. And I'm sure it will pass amazingly quickly. You know, when you come back off a trip and you have, you know, your first piece of pizza or your beer or whatever, you know, your first gin and tonic, it feels a bit, you know, but your 50th one, you don't even realize you're eating it, you know.
Yeah. No, I've had that conversation a lot the last few weeks. Everyone say, oh, so much happier, doing so much less, and the kids are happier, and it's all just calmer and easier.
Yeah.
It won't last because of Instagram, basically, won't it?
I think basically human beings are psychotic. I think we live in this sort of psychotic state of, you know, everything's like almost everything's an illusion, but it's only when you really get down to the reality, when you're in the middle of the ocean. You know, there'll be no illusions.
No, it just is, and you do it, and there's nothing else. Well, not nothing else to worry about. That's the other thing about this trip. Like, obviously, I'm 10 years on from big trips, and so I'm taking a sat phone and I'm staying in contact with home, which, well, we did take a sat phone once to Patagonia, but like, if it was me in a different, like, in a parallel universe, it was just me, I wouldn't take any of that stuff. You know, is it Sylvia Vidal? She goes out to Baffin or whatever, she just goes on her own and comes home when she's finished.
Yeah.
Like, this modern spin on having to document every movement and trackers and beepers.
Yeah.
It's very arbitrary, really, but it's
part. You're burdened.
You're
burdened by people who love you, that's the problem.
So that, absolutely, like, I will take enough to keep them healthy and happy and calm. But, like, yeah, in a different world, if it was me making the decisions, it wouldn't be as tracked and managed. It would just be my endeavor and my, you know, it's a very selfish thing.
Yeah.
You know, there's a movie called The Circle where for Facebook is sharing your experience with people that can't. And that's part of this vicarious fuel that you can offer everyone, because they can sort of live in the moment of it. But there must be some, I hope people enjoy the value of that, but it's the whole Instagram thing. This is the first time I've ever really used Instagram, is for this project. And the whole thing is a challenge for me. That's one of the hard things about this whole thing. I like the social media side of it, and the advertising, and the keeping the shiny front on it is not really my forte.
Yeah. The performance.
It is, isn't it? It's a very interesting tone that you set yourself to.
Yeah. But, you have to be careful what you say. You know, you don't want to upset anybody, you know.
No.
Don't mention politics.
And then I saw one of your podcasts, you said 50,000 people, so I'm checking the phrasing that I'm using now.
Oh, God. But, don't take any advice from me, definitely.
Well, no, I'm not. No advice. Just speaking to 50,000 people is plenty enough to temper your words, isn't it?
I think though, you have to, I think when people actually hear you speaking, you can get away with things that it wouldn't work if it was written down. People, like, I had an interesting thing where someone, I almost like lost someone who was sponsoring me, because they thought I was being homophobic until someone else pointed out I was actually being the opposite. I was actually being, what's the opposite of homophobic? You know, I have like, you know, why, if someone had known me for like 20 years, you know, like some people do, why would I suddenly become homophobic? Yeah. You know, like, you know, if you, it's this weird thing where people will, I think we just get so used to reading, you know, what people write and what, you know, what people say is very, very different. You miss the subtlety of things. So it was an interesting thing. So, someone was saying that when Kennedy died, you know, when they had the, you know, when they had the famous, what's his name? You know, he announced live on TV in the US, like Walter Cronkite, you know, the president has been killed. And the story was all these men were in this newsroom and they were all watching the television. And one of them was like, this is it. This is the end of newspapers. Like from now on, everyone is going to just be getting the news from the television. And then he went out the building and he was walking along and he saw there was like lines of people just queuing to buy newspapers. And he said, unless you read it, it's not real. You know, so, and I guess it's kind of, there's an interesting thing of social media where people are getting this sort of condensed, it's condensed down to its raw element of just good or bad, angry, happy, you know, long form. You're going to do the ultimate long form.
Essay, essay.
Yeah. You know, all that stuff will mean nothing, you know, how many followers you've got.
And it does, doesn't it, really? But it's, there must be some, there's incredible value in it. That's the confusion for me still is, you know.
Yeah, I guess, Well, you know, Taylor Swift's got like 100 million followers.
Yeah, she can monetize it faster than my 900 will.
But do you want to be, do you want to be Taylor Swift, really?
That's a question for a different podcast.
You want, go and read Nicki Minaj's lyrics to Anaconda, you know, and then decide if you, you know, what's the value to the world and the universe of being famous, you know?
True. No, I'm certainly not questing fame in any stretch.
But really, you're on the wild, you know, what you're about to do, you're on the wild frontier of, you know, like a lot of people who are super wealthy are actually now, instead of buying a Porsche or, you know, buying a jet, they're rowing across the Atlantic, or they're climbing Everest, or they're doing the Marathon de Sable. And I think people have realised that, you know, that those things are easily bought. You have to actually do them.
Yeah, I guess that's satisfying. Like, I have always aimed for that sort of stuff. Is that, well, like part of my, I think my early years climbing tick list was always built by what other people thought was hard or other people thought was cool. So, you know, someone says, like the Marmolada's hard because no one can climb it in a day, and this is when your punter's learning at school or whatever, learning at uni, and everyone's like, oh, 20 pitches is impossible, so that goes on the list. Yeah. You get to the valley and then someone says, oh, you can't climb this clean, or you can't do that in a day, and you're like, oh yeah. Or so those sort of stuff end up on the list. And yeah, there's a simple way to make a tick list of what other people write down as impressive.
Yeah,
like, oh, I'll just go and do those because they must be worth having.
Heard what they are.
yeah, that helps. It's all very building up the justification for these things is.
Did you collect things when you were a kid? Did you collect loads of like toy soldiers or line them all up or anything like that?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Like played a lot of Warhammer as a young teenager, and I'm just training the 4-year-old to get back into it. So that's
A bit it's not lead anymore.
No, but
they're made out of plastic now. They're all made in China, probably.
You can still lick the paint off the brush, so you get your dose. Definitely lining things up and putting things in places and neat and square and tidy away.
Yeah, the thing is, you're trying to find order in something which is complete chaos, like the ocean or a mountain.
Yeah, but then why would you choose chaos? Why wouldn't you just choose something that's really neat to start with and tidy it up?
Yeah,
I don't know. Yeah, there's something more. Yeah, we're definitely some way down some spectrum or other that.
Yeah,
this is at the justifiable route. But
I think
that's why aid climbing appealed as well. Aid climbing is very prosaic, isn't it? You're crafting like a solution. You're not necessarily being athletic or freestyle. There's no, there's nothing out of control in it. It's hyper controlled mechanics.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, you're forming like small solutions that sum up to this massive puzzle. And I think that appealed until it was, I don't think I could do it again. I don't think I could go back to it. I don't know how you can still do it. Like, I picture some of the cruxes now, and I just think, like, it just turns my insides. Like, I do wonder if I could ever go back and repeat what we did at the time.
Yeah. Because Vanessa, because I did five walls with my wife, Vanessa.
Yeah.
And the first wall we ever did, we did the nose in the winter time, and she'd never literally, she'd jumped up a rope once at a climbing wall. She had no experience whatsoever. And it was crazy. There was like four of us, three of them had never done anything like that before.
Yeah.
But then the last route we did tribal right, you know, which has got some quite hard pitches on it. And she was leading, you know, we like swapping leads. And she, at the end, she'd like, oh, I'm over it now. Like I don't want to. It was just too scary, you know. Yeah. It was too scary for too long, and I was like, oh, I don't really feel like that. I could keep doing it a bit longer because I find it really scary, and but you think you'd get better. You know, people have the illusion that you're not going to be scared. Like someone said, oh, you only need like 15 bird beaks on that route, and you probably need about 30, and so you had this terror, you know, of like, I'm running out of bird beaks. I've got miles to go. I don't want to go and take any out. Yeah, and the anxiety of it. And I was like, why can't I just be like Jim Bridwell and just be like, hey, man, I'm going to take a big fall here. You know, I'm just going to back clean these bird beaks all the way.
Oh, no. Imagine. Back cleaning's the scariest thing you can do in life.
But you don't think that people, maybe you have to do that. Maybe you have to pretend, act like the person people think you are.
Yeah. Well, there's part of that in everyone, isn't there? Yeah, there's some bravado. It's just when it catches up with you.
Yeah, hold the line till you can't.
You don't get to sleep for a week, do you?
Yeah.
Like, oh, have to do it now. Yeah, that's... Yeah, I don't think I've bitten off more than I can chew this time, though. At least in terms of, like, the... I'm not worried about it. Like, if tomorrow I had to go and climb tribal right, I would be worried.
Yeah,
but this one I feel like I've got it squared away enough that I'm not worried. I'm just going through the motions now, which is how it should feel, I think.
I used to have this technique where I would imagine, and if you just keep on going, if you can cope in that second, like I find this at the moment really, like, you know, you're not starving to death right in this moment, you know, still alive, you know, just live like that rather than think stressing about what's going to happen next month or next year.
Yeah,
but. But when you're in an intense experience where you just want to turn around the whole time, I always had this thing of this gnarly old man, like fisherman, holding on to is it a tiller on those little yeah. You know, those little boats that go out, you know, Robin Hood's Bay, they go out fishing. You know, the really gnarly old fisherman with his gnarly hand on this tiller, and he would not turn it. He'd be going out there into the storm because he was so experienced. He wasn't afraid of the sea. And I would always have this image of like your hand on the tiller, do not turn the tiller, just keep going. And you knew from experience you would go out and you would come back. Yeah, but if you weren't experienced, you'd be like, oh God, the boat nearly went over then. Oh my God, the boat's going over. Oh, turn around. I haven't got a life jacket on. So so just keep going or breaking through the ice or whatever. But but building your own boat reminds me, have you ever read John Turk's book, Cold Oceans?
No.
Oh, so if you can get a copy of it, it's really good. But at the beginning, he's a fisherman in the Grand Banks, and someone tells him you can't toast the Queen with your feet on the table unless you've been around Cape Horn. So it's Cape Horn. That's the Cape Horn. That's the one down in Argentina, isn't it?
Yeah.
So he decides to kayak around there in a Klepper kayak. But he'd never been kayaking before, so he goes down there, puts his kayak together, and sets off. And he ends up getting in this huge storm, and he gets thrown out, and his shoulder gets dislocated, like while he's like drowning, and somehow he survives. And so then because he doesn't go around Cape Horn, then he comes back again. He meets this guy who's going to sail around Cape Horn, who's built his own boat. So they get in this boat, and they must sail all the way down from Canada, all the way down to, you know, around South America, and they're sailing around in this huge storm. And this guy built the boat. The carpenter's like, look, man, I built this boat, and I'm telling you, it can't survive this. It's too much. And the boat's like creaking and groaning. And but John Turkey said he didn't want to die like in the boat. So he got out there and he was like holding on to the rigging in this huge storm. And he was like getting the full effect. You know, I'm going to die anyway. I'm going to experience it. You know, like the supernova. I'm getting onto the outside of the starship and see the supernova. And he survived. So then he had this amazing memory where his friend was like just cowering in the bottom, probably screwing the screws back in again as we're popping out. But do you have more confidence in your vessel because you built it yourself?
Well, yeah, I think so. I hope so. I don't know the opposite, but I know that I've done everything right. Like, it's the first time I've ever built anything where I've actually cared about every detail. Like, normally you can get away with stuff. Like, the van is perfectly good and it works great. Most of it works great, but it's not like flawless by any stretch. Yeah. And the boat isn't flawless, but it's built to a standard where I don't have anything to niggle me.
Yeah.
Because I knew that if I had even a loose cable clip or a bad connection or anything like that, a lazily made fiberglass panel, you name it,
yeah,
I would know the whole time. So I knew that going in. So from like day one, it's built above the standard that I need it to be to keep me happy.
Yeah.
And I know what that level is, and I can deal with some stuff, and other people would deal with different stuff, I suppose. And we will, like, what the reason I can't yet go is that we haven't really had the testing. So we've had it out and it floats, but I haven't really given it a thrash and I haven't checked that it self-rights yet.
Yeah.
So there's a few like boxes to tick. Not that I'm worried about them, but you just need them crossed off basically.
Yeah.
The other justification for building it is you read all the stories and I don't know, 50% of ocean rows, either the water maker or the autopilot breaks. And then there's like chaos. What do we do? How do we fix it? All this sort of stuff. And I'm like, well, if you don't know, then should you really be out there at that point if you don't know where the fuse is or how it's wired or what your options are? So that was why I wanted to build it, so that I knew where every fuse and wire and you name it is and goes and how to fix everything because I put it there in the first place.
Oh, super cool. Who's the famous Swedish guy who builds like he's like 80 now and he builds. He's been around the world and he's like self-built tiny boats. Like, have you ever come across him?
Yeah, I think so.
And all he takes is sardines and muesli for like a year. That's all he eats.
Well, this is the other thing. His expedition food is cripplingly expensive.
Yeah.
Like, space food is like £8 a pack. It's astounding. So I too am on destination, like home bargains to see what I can make to be, because you're supposed to eat 6,000 calories a day, which is quite hard anyway.
If
you do that with expedition food, you can spend $4,000 or $5,000.
Yeah.
Which is, that doesn't fit with my idiom of giving money to the hospital and me eating $5,000 worth of space food. So yeah, that food is a real crux at that point. It's not like a climbing trip where you can just be hungry for 3 weeks.
Because this guy's like, oh, people are so bored. Their lives are so boring that they have to fill it with all this different food. But really, all you need is like one tin of sardines and an Alpen twice a day.
No, I need more than that. But I'll be happy with this. Like, I'm the sort of guy that eats the same breakfast every day anyway. So
yeah.
I don't mind eating the same stuff as long as it's the right stuff.
What did they used to eat in the you know, Chair Blythe and all those people? What did they used to eat?
They took stoves and stuff. Yeah, I think mostly tin stuff. They did. The book is amazing. They did eat a variety, I think, but it must have been mostly tinned goods or preserved goods at least, and catch fish, I suppose.
Yeah.
I don't know.
In the Lindemann book, there's bits where like the dolphin comes along and you're like, oh, there's a dolphin. He's like, stabs it in the head, just pulls it in, like sucks the water out of its eyes, and then like just drinks the blood and throws it back in. It's like, oh, God, that's. You know, you won't be doing that on Instagram, that's for sure.
No. I'm not into that. Everyone mentions fishing as soon as you say it. And if you do, your deck just becomes an abattoir.
Yeah.
It's just going to be gruesome after the first 10 meals of clubbing ocean fish. Like, that doesn't appeal at all. And plus, you're just wasting time, basically.
Yeah.
You could be rowing. And that's the other thing people ask you about. Like, time comes up a lot, obviously, because people think you're away for 2 months. Oh, what are you going to do for 2 months? Like, you must have loads of books and movies and stuff. And you're like, no, you're missing the whole. You're missing the whole point here, too. And I know, like, if I took a Kindle, I could easily read it for an extra 20 minutes a day, just as a luxury, as a treat in the morning. And then, you know, 20 minutes a day is 3 days worth of rowing over 2 months or whatever.
Are you going to listen to... Are you going to have, like, something to listen to?
Yeah, that is the one luxury I fitted was speakers and a stereo.
Yeah.
So it's capable. It's got a big memory stick in, so I can take MP3s and podcasts or whatever. But... So that is the one luxury. If there's enough power from the solar and the wind, then you can turn that on.
Yeah.
And I ummed and ahed about fitting that because weight and cost and all the rest of it. But
yeah,
it seems to be the, you know, a bit of
like having a Bible, you know, in another age, like taking the Bible, but now it's like having Joe Rogan or something.
Yeah. No, I think I'll choose carefully. Could listen to 24 hours of that stuff.
I know Alex Gammer, when he skied to and from the South Pole, which is like 2,000 kilometers by himself, is, I think it took like 100 days. And he brought the day in the morning. It was school time. So he would listen to like podcast, you know, like audiobooks about like languages or the great speeches. And then in the afternoon, it was like entertainment. So he'd listen to, he had all the Beatle albums, or he'd have all the Rolling Stone albums. And then and then on an evening, he would watch one episode of South Park every day. And he said, you know, where other people were like literally they had two sheets of toilet roll, you know, to wipe their asses on, and they had nothing to read and nothing to. So that kind of, I think that depressurizing yourself is really important.
Yeah, I used to listen to music when I was solo a lot, like climbing, one headphone in.
Yeah. Just,
I think this is, again, like when it's filling, it takes away that 5%. It sort of cancels out the space where you could make considerations and long-term thoughts and that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
It keeps you in the moment a bit more, doesn't it?
You might get sick of yourself, though, if you just...
Yeah, imagine.
I remember when I was when I went to Antarctica, there was a guy there who was like, oh, I don't believe in listening to music, and I just listened to the sound of the wilderness. And on the very, very, very last day, he had to ski and grab something that we'd left behind, you know, and we were like, oh, listen to some music. And he put these earphones in and skied off. He came back, it was like a religious, it was like this amazing epiphany. Like, he was in this beautiful place with this amazing music.
Yeah.
It was like the highlight of the entire trip. So I think you can have this kind of really hard, stoical, oh, I'm just going to eat, you know, like rocks. I'm just going to take a lot of rocks and eat them. But when you get there, it's that whole thing about your future self, isn't it? You're writing these checks. It's like, you bastard, why don't you bring an MP3 player, you know?
Yeah. There'll be some regrets. I'm not sure which. Probably this,
And do you think, I guess the thing is on this kind of thing, it's always the small thing. It's a small leak, or it's the rubbing seam or something that's going to...
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's... Right.
It'll basically be the hole in your backside. That'll be most of your concern. like that sort of niggles, obviously, we've all dealt with to some degree. So that they'll come and go. But yeah, there'll be something. I think it might be in the sleeping system. I just get the feeling that because of the cabin that I've built in this boat, you step onto your bed. So if you step in, you'll get wet every time. And I haven't quite... And the North Atlantic is notoriously much wilder and wetter. So the Southern, you can see, like, you could probably get in dry most of the time. The North, not so much. And that transition to a damp sleeping bag for 2 months, I haven't quite rationalized yet.
What kind of sleeping bag have you got?
I bought the most bargainous square synthetic thing that I could find. Because weight's an issue, but it's not the issue, really.
Yeah.
So this thing's, and you don't have to pack it. So it's like 25 quid, synthetic, square cut, so square feet, because I didn't want to be in a mummy bag for 2 months, especially with sweaty crotches and bums and those sorts of things. So it's square, and it's rated to like -6. So it's like a thermarest, top and bottom, made out of synthetic insulation. Bargain. Absolute bargain. 25 quid.
Caravan sleeping bag.
Like... the cheapest of the caravan sleep bags, but thick, And so that, and I put a multi-mat to a 40mm ice foam mat. So I've gone for that. Because I didn't want to sleep on, like, big foamy cushions. But you see a lot of people put foamy cushions in, but then they're covered in polyurethane. They'd just be, like, horrendously sticky the whole time.
Yeah.
So...
Have you thought about using like a buffalo sleeping bag on the, or like a fiber pile bag on the inside?
Yeah, I think that could well be an option. I mean, it won't. It'll be warm. It'll be hot in the cabin. That's.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It's more like a drape than it is anything.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's only a couple of months, isn't it? You'll be tired. You'll sleep. But you'll be knackered.
So you just fall asleep.
And plus, you can't make it, like, if you made it crisp and super comfy, why would you go and sit in the spray in the rain for 12 hours when you could have an extra half an hour in really luxurious comfort? So it should be equally as uncomfortable as the rowing seat, I think.
Yeah.
So that it's just there's no transition between them in terms of joy.
Are you afraid of sea monsters or, you know?
No, I don't think so. So there's a really cool clip. Someone on the southern, they did a route to French Guiana from Africa, and there's a clip of him, and he's suckered his GoPro on underneath, and you have to swim underneath now and again to clean the barnacles and muck off the bottom, and he's got a window cleaning sucker, and he's surfing upside down on the underside of his boat while it's whipping along in a downwind, and while he's cleaning this bottom.
Really?
That, to me, like, if I can get that shot, I'll be made. Like, I'll be so happy if I get to upside down surf the boat on a downwind leg. I mean, that to me just looks amazing. I did a bit of free diving like a few years ago. That was another one of the fill-ins, like arbitrary fill-ins, because you can learn a lot quickly, but there's not actually much to learn with free diving because you just hold your breath.
And wait.
So it didn't last too long, but when it did, it's pretty exciting. So I've got a rough idea of how to be underwater for a period. I want to use those skills. I'm quite looking forward to that.
So if you didn't row at all, once you got out from the land, do you just kind of drift and get blown over there anywhere?
Yeah, some dude, a French guy in his 70s, did it in a barrel this last season. Like, he built himself a 4-meter by 5-meter barrel with a bed and a rally car seat in it.
Yeah.
And nothing else, a hatch at the top. And he floated for, like, I think 100 days or something from Antigua from the Canaries to the Bahamas. So
you beat the other guys who were rowing like super fast.
You see some soloists do 90 days. I think there was a pair this year was close to 100 days, so, you know, it's just a bit of luck. So downwind these, and the boat I've built, this to get into the detail of ocean rowing, that you can get boats with equal height cabins front and back. They're traditional class, and they've got a deeper V-shaped hull, so they sort of sit in the water and they don't take as much windage. And then my one's got a huge, relatively huge cabin at the front. And the naysayers call it a spinnaker cabin because it's there to catch any downwind draft that you've got. And the bottom shaped more like a surfboard. So it sits on top. There's very little drag. Massive front cabin, tiny back cabin. And it just takes the downwind and runs with it.
Right.
So they just don't go into a headwind. It's like, it's all stop if the wind's around. You've got like a big parachute you can put out, and it just acts as a drag anchor and slows you backwards. But they're designed to go with the wind, and you just sit on the prevailing, and that's why the northern route works in the summer and the equatorial route works in the winter. And
maybe people will be doing this all the time to go on holiday soon, you know, when there's no players.
Yeah, that's it.
I'm off to Miami. I'm going down to Portugal, and I'm going to row across. I'll be back in 2 years. Like,
punt across and then cruise up the eastern seaboard and come back across the north in the summertime.
Well, that's like Hans Roma. He was the first, I don't know if you know about Hans Roma, he was the first person to cross the Atlantic in a kayak after the First World War. But he only kayaked across because he wanted to move to America and get work there. And he went from Portugal, and he got to the Caribbean, then he disappeared. Like in a hurricane, these people, like, you know, the Polynesians in their dugout canoes crossing the, you know, the Pacific Ocean,
questing up in New Zealand.
Yeah, amazing.
No, it's nothing like that. It's definitely not as amazing as any of that. It's just a daft way to spend a couple of months. But
and how are you going to sell your boat when you get to the other side? Have you got a buyer?
Well, no, but there's a surprising market in secondhand product. Because it seems like the Talisker race this year had something like 26 or 28 entrants, and there's probably 10 or 12 independent crossings as well each year.
Yeah,
various ocean, and most of them, a large percentage of them are British, or at least Northern European. So it seems to be that there's enough market to keep them moving around. And yeah. I don't really need much value out of it. Like, I'll be able to sell it at the bottom of the market and still make a profit on it.
Yeah.
Because if I went out to a shop and bought, or went to the boat builders and bought this, it might even be worth 85 grand.
Right.
So if I can take the 25 I need out of that, then that would be, like, I'm not going to try and rip anyone off for it.
And where do you get the plans from? If anyone listens to this wants to build their own ocean-going rowing boat.
That was quite a quest. It wasn't an easy thing to find. There's basically one guy. Well, there's a few ocean rowing boat designers, but there's one chap's designed about 80 or 90% of the fleet over the last 30 years. So it was just a game in finding his contact details. And I don't want to spoil it for anyone. If you do want to do it, then that's part of the sport, isn't it? And I managed to get hold of him. And serendipitously, at the same time, there was a father and son in Bulgaria had asked him the same question. So we split the cost of the plans.
Oh, wow.
Small world. So they built one too. And they were hoping to do the same route as me. So perhaps our stars will align eventually, but it is doable. And then you just go out and learn the rest of it. So you get on YouTube like you do for anything else that you want to learn how to fly the glass and learn about marine electronics and everything else in between.
you have to learn
to find the time,
because
I think that's right, it's the other novelty to us. It just seems like it's what we do, but I think people are surprised that we can live the life we do and achieve that in a year. You can cut out a lot of the slack, basically, can't you? So if you want to find 1,000 hours to build a boat, you just don't do anything else.
Just get up 5 hours earlier.
Well, that does help, yeah, definitely. But then, the kids started sleeping through, I suppose, start of the project or near about, so that helped. Or the last of the children sloping through. But basically, I worked on it 2 to 3 hours every night and 5 hours every weekend night without fail. But what I found, because I work a full-time job and we've got 4 kids, so you can't start before the kids are in bed, because that's not fair on anyone. And then you still have to do the washing up and stuff. So you've got to fit those in. So it gives me like 7:30 till 10:30. But you don't really, if you've commuted and done a day at work and come home and done tea, bath, bed, you can't really function fully at 9:30 on a Thursday night.
Yeah.
But what you have to have done, I found, is you spend all day like going through the motions of what you're going to do that evening. So when you get out there, you're almost robotic, in that you've done it twice because you did it on the commute in, and your hands are like, there's no thought left.
Yeah.
If you have to solve something when you're that knackered, you can't actually solve it. But if you just go out and apply solutions that you've come up with when you're clear headed at 2:30, then it actually works all right. And it worked for me, but I think it takes a lot of effort. And obviously you don't do anything else.
And is your wife, is she an obsessive asshole as well? Has that got in her nature?
Yeah, she is entirely capable and incredibly focused.
Yeah.
So, she did an Ironman the year before Heidi was born. So she was a really good triathlete when I was a climber. And then obviously we've got 4 children, so she's fully committed to that endeavor. Last year she set up a sewing business, so she's been doing a lot of sewing. So while I was building the boat, she was setting up a sewing business. So we understand the level of application that we're both capable of, I think.
Yeah,
it's a mutual understanding. And I think as well, as long as it's an acceptable endeavor, this is the funny thing, like say, like, I'm getting back into painting models and Airfix kits and Warhammer again, you couldn't say to Kate, oh, I'm just going to have, you know, 3 hours every day for a year painting models next year. It wouldn't quite come with the same, like, avoidance of every bedtime. So there's something about, like, a socially acceptable, and for some people, maybe that is, like, that's awesome.
Get out. Yeah.
But, like, we have, it has to be a balance between you of what is an acceptable use of your time.
Yeah.
You're like, yeah, you can do that. That's cool. And you get on with it. But yeah, you can't have the luck. You can't do the luxury stuff. You can't just crank out Netflix for 3 hours a night.
That is,
expect to be supported in your choices.
I think that is a sad thing in the, do you know, when you go past the, you know, old people, when I was growing up, you get old people and they would build these by hand, build these like steam engines. You know, and they would spend like their whole lives building all this shit that, you know, it was just totally obsessive. But people don't seem to have the time because they're too busy on watching the telly or being on the computer. Like I'm the, you know, it's kind of hard to, you know what, because all those kind of stupid things you do, like you've basically training yourself to become a, you know, a ship builder. You could probably build a yacht next, you know. And but you wouldn't be doing that if you were just arguing with people about Brexit on Facebook.
No, but you can choose not to do that. You can choose not to do that now and forever. But it seems like a very difficult decision to make these days. But you just have to not.
Yeah. And don't get thrown into.
Yeah, I got to Friday nights and you can't do anything but lie still. So I have watched movies in the last year because I couldn't function to do anything else by the end of some weeks. But generally, yeah, I don't do anything. It's the types of fun. Like, I don't, as a person, and this is just me, and I'm very jealous of those that can, but I don't really get the type one stuff. I don't think it is. And type two, to me, is that, like, it's got to really suck and be long and grim. Like, I don't, the sort of, what's fun? I don't know, snowboarding and those sorts of nice things where you just go and have a nice time.
On a sledge or something.
Yeah, I don't know. I struggle with the type one stuff. So I don't need to do it because I don't actually, like, it's an awful thing that I think I end up berating myself for having wasted the time when I could be doing something I didn't enjoy.
It's like skiing, isn't it? Like, skiing is so much fun. But you realize you're not really getting anywhere. Like, you might be getting better at skiing, but it's what point is skiing, you know?
It's that. So I end up hating myself for having enjoyed something because I could have been not enjoying it, which would have been better later. Isn't that awful?
Yeah.
But that's why you're jealous of people that can. Like,
but do you feel the lovely. But do you ever think it, like, I always think of myself as a very lazy person, but I, you know, like at 6 a.m, I'm feeling like I'm having a lie. I've got to get up. I've got to get on with this stupid book, you know, and, you know, I'll be doing it. I could be doing it till like 10 o'clock at night. I'm doing like 13, 14 hour days every single day on this stupid book. You know, you're eating your food in front of the computer. And like, I've illustrated this entire book. I've added a year to this project by fucking illustrating the whole thing. I could have done it in a day if I took photographs. But there's that thing in you that's like, this is the hardest thing to do. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to do it the hardest way.
Yeah, and then some other thing goes on and says, like, oh, well, such and such could do it faster or better or longer. Or why do you go to bed at 11? Why don't you stay up till 12? You need 6 hours sleep. But who are these people that we imagine do 18-hour days and parent and all the rest of it?
Like,
there's some enigma of a thing out there that just berates anyone into thinking they're not doing well enough.
It's funny because my ex-wife is an academic, you know, works in university, and this week I had this like really amazing conversation with her, probably the first time since we got divorced a long time ago, and she said, "I'm having to work at home." And it suddenly made me realize how amazing it is, all those years where you were self-employed, having to self-motivate yourself. How did you ever do it? And I'm like, I don't even think about it anymore. But the idea of just going to work and just probably getting away with the minimum and getting paid at the end of the week. It's, you know, it's a, so it's better on the other side.
Well, yeah, it is, isn't it? It's always grass is always greener. But there's, yeah, that intrinsic motivation only comes with an interest, doesn't it? It only comes if you want to be that in that position. But I couldn't be motivated to do other people's hobbies or, you know, run for 1,000 days in a row.
Yeah,
just does DIY. Which is, so you're only going to motivate if it's remotely interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, it's got to be impossible to be worthwhile.
For me, it does. Yeah, at least a hint of impossibility.
I guess the more you get when you do these things that people think are crazy or impossible, you realise they're not, and then it makes each one kind of falls down like dominoes. That, you know, it's almost like it's a con that sailing around the world was actually difficult. It actually was quite easy. You're building your own house. You know, it was a faff, yeah. But. It wasn't impossible, or running your own business, or having kids, or...
I know. Yeah, there's not many impossibles left, I don't think. There are some improbables and very expensive things, but in terms of basic human endeavour, everything's been done.
Apart from caving.
Caving's just hard, but the skill set's there. You just got to go and get lost more, haven't you?
Yeah, and come back
someone's
again.
Someone's been to the end of that thing. Yeah, like the cave divers, where they dive in and bivvy like 3 times, and they're diving for like 3 days in a row. That stuff is that's almost improbable.
Yeah,
not possible.
You're on a different planet.
I think if I lived in Yorkshire, I've always said that if I lived in Yorkshire, I'd be a cave diver. It does appeal. That's very ducks in a row, isn't it? It's very squared away and not actually exciting because it's all pre-planned and. Just application of skill set.
Yeah. Tick all the boxes that can be ticked.
So that's where these arbitrary rulings, that's the build your own boat or the climb without a hammer or whatever it is that makes it hard for you. You've got to make it a question mark, haven't you? Like, I don't like doing the stuff that's certain. It's got to have a thing question. And if it doesn't, then you can make it harder. Or you do it with a child on your back or, you know, you can... just make it arbitrary, so it's a question mark again.
Better than building a duck house or a bird house anyway, so.
Yeah, no, that was this week's game, was building a chicken hutch.
So I guess I'll get back to you when you've come back and we'll find out how it all went, shall I?
Yeah, it could be a year or more, but stay in touch.
Yeah.
This is all over.
Well, it's been great. It's been great talking to you. You've got some good,
thank you.
I think you're going to be fine. It sounds like it's been an amazing experience anyway. I'm very jealous. I want to build a boat now.
Hey, get after it. I'll give you the plans and the spreadsheet and you can just get to it.
Yeah.
Cool.
Vanessa, I'm building a boat. Yeah.
Yeah. You just need 21 feet.
21 feet, right.
And find a
shed. Okay, Pete. We're gonna finish this just before the internet completely dies. So
yes, I know.
All right, have a good night.
Awesome. Cheers to you.
Bye.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona Tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.